I'll kick your motherfucking ass. That big ass head. Look at your hairline.
You will never find blom 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 a hairline like mine.
Your shit is way back here. If you was in the army, you had to sloop like this.
Yes, sir.
Your shit is fucked up. You ain't got a forehead, you got a five head.
Two developmental psychologists, four developmental psychologists, and everyday folk with an interest in infant and child development. I am Candy LaPan.
And I am Dion Benton, and welcome back to another episode. Hello, Candy. How are you doing? It's been a long time.
It has been. I feel like it's been forever, but yeah, hanging in there, doing all right.
That's kind of what a semester does to you.
Yeah, it's that point in the semester. That's for
right,
sure.
Right. And this is a particularly strange semester because none of us have had a break. Right.
No.
And I have typically at this point we would have had fall break and a whole bunch of other things. But yeah, I'm hanging in there, and it sounds like you are, and I'm glad to be back for what this is the 11th episode.
Yeah, I'm very excited today, and very excited to speak with our guest.
Yes. So we are. It's our pleasure actually to be able to introduce Dr. Charisse Pickron. She is currently a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Minnesota. She received her PhD at the University of Massachusetts Amherst in 2018 in developmental psychology. She is interested in the intersection of perceptual and sociocognitive development, and she investigates changes in infants' perception and representations of people and face groups within their environment. We are super excited to have you on the podcast, and the reason I'm especially excited is because I'm actually speaking to someone who looks like me. Someone who is another sort of what's the acronym we use now? BIPOC.
BIPOC. Yeah, BIPOC, I don't know.
Right.
BIPOC or B. I don't know the.
Yeah, right. I don't know.
The trending pronunciation.
Right, right.
BIPOC.
BIPOC. Yeah. So we get to speak to another fellow BIPOC.
We are very excited.
Yeah.
So how are you doing today, Dr. Charisse?
I'm hanging in there, right? This has been quite the wild week, but. Wouldn't expect anything else, given that it's 2020 and the entire year has been upside down and sideways for all of us. So hanging in.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, so today we're going to start off the episode by discussing today's hot topic. And so today's hot topic is everything to do with the election. And specifically, we have some pointed questions we want to ask. But yeah, it's just going to be sort of our take on the recent events in politics. If you've been slightly awake, you may know that Biden
just
is now
a little
on
bit.
The lead. Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah.
We'll be talking about, you know, what a Joe Biden presidency means to us, why we can't do with another 4 years with Trump, much less another second with him, among other things. So yeah,
it's the hot topic probably everywhere right now. So we figured it was a pretty good topic for us today. So
absolutely.
The reason I chose this hot topic is because this is something I've thought a lot about actually, about what a Trump presidency means and has meant for me, and how I absolutely couldn't. I don't know what I would have done. I would have survived, of course. We're resilient, but like. I don't know what I would have done mentally to sort of prepare myself for another 4 years, right? Trump is he's as divisive as they come. He's shown no desire or willingness to try to unite us. It's sort of Democrat counties this, Democrat cities this, Republican cities that, he's sided in many different ways and on many different occasions with quite straightforwardly and unequivocally racist groups. And he's shown no contrition. And I don't even think he understands what that means. And so for me, this is a momentous moment, so to speak. And I am I recognize that Joe Biden isn't, everyone's ideal candidate.
Sure.
But that, yeah, no, but
we'll
I don't think
with, we'll go with that, right? Yeah, he's not like our top draft pick here, but
I think that people are fooling themselves to think that way to begin with. Joe Biden is a means to an end. And yeah, he's not perfect. And he wasn't my first choice, but I think he's a step in the right direction. And so that's why I am, I'm hopeful for these next 4 years. Now, of course, the election hasn't been called, but I mean, everybody sees the writing on the walls.
Yeah, just to give everybody a sense of where we are, like, it's 10 o'clock in the morning-ish on the 6th. So we are currently looking at, he's in the lead, but obviously still a ways to go in terms of counting.
Right. Yep. Every ballot has to be counted.
Right.
Exactly.
I think that's so surprising that we are at a point where that also is a conversation that we have to have. And I think that speaks to a lot of the issues of, it should never be that the way to get into a position of power is that you will do anything and even suppress people's votes. And I think that speaks volumes about anybody that would want to do that. You don't have anybody's true interest at heart except for your own to try and cheat the system and not hear people's voices. So that has been a continued theme throughout this election. That's been a really hard one to grapple with.
Yeah, it seems like their argument at this point is, if we should stop the count in Philadelphia, we should, do a recount in Wisconsin and Minnesota, but yet let's not snap the count in Arizona or Nevada. Like that makes absolutely no sense. Another argument they make is that, if we stop the count, a couple of days ago, Trump would have won. That's like me saying if I hit a jump shot in the first quarter, that I would have won.
That you win.
We stop the game, but that's not the way games work. That's not the way politics works. That's not the way elections work. You count every vote. And actually, I don't want to take Charisse's thunder, but she made a joke at the beginning of the podcast before we started recording about all votes matter. I'll let you tell that joke.
Oh, I've been seeing on social media that folks who make the argument that all lives matter are mad or real salty about the fact that all votes or all ballots matter too. So I can't say that was the original idea of that one, but I've been seeing it, and I do really appreciate that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it is important, and because, if we really are fighting, I think what I think I see a lot of is, people that argue for, the freedom in our country, and the another theme of this election has been, fighting against socialism and communism, which, that's been a lot of the things regurgitated, and it's like, but you do realize that, the central tenet of a democracy is that we all vote, so if you're fighting against communism, then you should want every vote to be counted, and it's really hard to disentangle some of these things that people do mental gymnastics to.
But that's what happens when your foundation is made of sand. That's what I said. That's what happens when your foundation is made of sand, right? They've never really had a solid foundation, and so much of what they're doing right now is just trying to throw shit at the walls to see if it sticks. Today is their moment of reckoning. And that's what I was saying to a friend last night. You can't go around calling people sleepy this and dog that and, giving out dog whistles and trying to divide us at every turn and trying to stifle the vote and then expect people to vote. The fact that he's surprised that he is not winning the Electoral College, much less the popular vote, it's not surprising. I mean, you can't tear people down at every turn and then expect for us to turn around and support you. That's not the way this works.
I'm still surprised, though, honestly, that it has been as close as it is. When you say, what does it mean to me to have a Biden presidency going forward, or if it was a Trump presidency going forward, honestly, that's very important, of course, because to me, as somebody who, hopes to, get married someday, and, a Trump presidency might, impact that in lots of ways, and all the things that you can imagine. Being an educator, there's lots of issues there that are important to us. Being somebody who has student loans, things are important to us. The list goes on of things that are important. But even with a Joe Biden win, I think just morally, I'm very discouraged to see how many people chose to set aside all the things that you're talking about. Because if you literally put every issue aside, just the common decency of the way that Trump interacts generally, to me, is disqualifying to be the leader of a country, like especially the leader of the United States, where, you know, it's name calling, it's hatred, it's just
undermining the very system that makes us who we are to begin with.
Yeah.
Like,
that is absolutely disqualifying. And the fact that Republicans are not standing up for democracy and for us is, it's not surprising, but it's maddening. Because it seems like there's nothing this guy can do for them to speak out. I mean, to be fair, there have been a handful of Republicans who have spoken out. You know, but there haven't been nearly as many as you would like, especially in a moment like this. We all see the writing on the walls. We know where this is going. It hasn't been called, but it's quite clear at this point. And like, I don't know if you all saw the press conference last night, but it was a sham, complete sham. He spent his entire time undermining the system, talking about legal votes and illegal votes. And apparently if the votes are coming from Philadelphia, they're illegal. But if they're coming from Arizona or Nevada, they're legal.
Then they count, yeah.
And they count, you know, that by itself should have, you know, led to some, you know, led the Republicans to speaking out, but that wasn't the case. And it's
I think, I mean, also speaking to me, just idea that the lack of moral compass, right? I mean, children, if we're all developmental scientists here, like children, infants show evidence of a moral understanding of relationships of between characters, between agencies, right? Like children have a much stronger sense of morality than our current person in the White House, that it really is concerning that this is okay.
Well, yeah. And I think that it does, there's no way, especially in the world today where, you know, information spreads so quickly and is shared at the press of a button, that like the things that he says are not influencing and inciting people to be more hateful. Not to say that those racist beliefs, homophobic beliefs, xenophobic beliefs are already
stand
there.
Stand back and stand by, Proud Boys.
Right. Like those beliefs were certainly already there. You know, it's not like they were created by him. And I think that that's important to make sure we don't just.
But he's given them life.
But he's given them life and encouraged it and normalized it. Because, like, we all know, again, like, as social scientists, we know that part of prejudice is, like, whether or not it's a group norm, right? Like, is this an acceptable thing to express? And it's become that a lot of, whether it's all of those isms, but also just that type of being dissenting and being divisive and being, you know, name calling. I mean, it's like we tell kindergartners not to call each other names, but like how are you going to teach that to children when you have the person who's the leader of our country that does that all the time?
I think one of the things I've been thinking a little bit about in terms of the hot topic questions that you had sent me is just, you know, like our country has been sick for so long, right? I mean, we've have since the founding of the country, in terms of the founding of the United States, not the, I guess, the land, who started living here first, but it's, we've been sick for so long that, and it's been constant, but in the last 4 years, to me, this illness has just been amplified, it's been magnified by the type of people that are in our power, right? I can't even really say leadership, I think, and, you know, it's not what you would even define as leadership, but and that's so concerning. And you know, but at the same time, obviously we're human, are adaptive and resilient, and we learn how to fight within the system, but fight and survive and do well and be you know, healthy as best as we can. But yeah, I mean, there's this illness that is just ramped up by what's happened in the last 4 years, at least my feelings on that.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So I was talking to a friend a couple of nights ago, and I was saying, because we were talking about just how, just what Candy was saying, that much of what Trump says should be disqualifying on its face, but yet it's not. And I think the reason why Trump is emboldened to say what he says is because it sticks. It works. If people were outspoken about half of what he says, I would doubt that he would say half of what he says. But the very fact that he has one a base that's fervently in support of him, and the fact that he has Republicans in his back pocket, sort of, I think, fuels him with this sort of sense that he has a license to say whatever and do whatever he wants. But again, I think if we spoke out, it would become quite clear. And that's exactly what's happening in this election. You know, this is, like I said, this is his reckoning. You know, the American people have spoken. And so I agree with both of you in that, like, it's disheartening, and like there's this rampant hate that sort of permeated all aspects of our lives. But I think that there is reason for optimism and hope, and it's the fact that the system is not broken. I mean, the very fact that we are in this position to begin with, and that Biden is on the precipice of winning, and Kamala Harris is on the precipice of being the first woman, African-American, or a woman of color vice president, I think shows that the system is at least still working. And so for me, that gives me hope.
I do. Absolutely. I do. And it gives me hope. I think this is probably a very specific issue, but to me, I think the Electoral College within itself needs to be abandoned.
Yeah. Not problematic.
Think about how silly it is. Think about how silly it is that Biden is up about 4 million votes, yeah, but we're still talking about who won the presidency.
How many times do we have to have somebody win the popular vote but lose the election? Like, right. No, there's just no sanity in that at this point. And so in terms of the system, I think that is one thing that needs to be corrected. Like, it's just not, it doesn't make any logical sense in any way. And it really does make people's votes not equal. Like, vote in North Carolina is not the same as somebody's vote in another place. Like,
well, the argument is if we do away with the Electoral College, Democrats are always going to win, which I think is a silly argument on its face. It's like, promote better Republican candidates. That's the solution.
I mean, but again,
and it's not like Republicans have never won. Republicans have never been popular.
What's the point of Voice of the People? Like, if we're really supposed to be the people, like, that's the point. Is like, it doesn't matter who would win. If most people,
then what they'll say,
person,
this is a representative democracy, not a direct democracy. Well, that's, they'll draw that distinction. Yeah, but yes,
they can. But right. I think that it is a true issue that we have to address. Like, because I mean,
absolutely,
it just logically doesn't make any sense. You know, the other option is, like, we all need to start moving to the Midwest because, like, I mean, have you seen the map where it, like, shows you the populace across different areas? It's just like,
it's like small smatters of blue, but mostly red.
And it's
right.
like, yeah. nobody right. lives there. Like, the populations right. are so.
Hey, I live here now.
Right?
I'm now in the Midwest.
Yeah. Like, we all need to migrate somewhere, apparently. It's like all around the coast, you know, that's where we see all these densely populated areas. And then you're not being represented in other places. So,
yeah,
I don't know. It's just, it's frustrating for sure for me. I think that's a big issue that we need to start thinking about. But
yeah. And yeah, I think, you know, for me, like, moving forward, my hope is that we bring kind of humility back in and rational thinking, stability, you know, the act of just being kind to one another. And not that, like, kindness is going to solve all problems, but, you know, just having having a level of respect for individuals.
Yeah.
You know, and also moving forward, I'm hoping that some of the kind of costs that have happened over the 4 years in terms of, you know, attacks on Title IX and attacks on public education, and again, I'm going to bring it back to families and children and developmental science. I mean, we live in a country where it's okay to cage children and separate them, and now we have hundreds of kids who can't be reunited, right? And
500 plus, and, to be exact.
And much of the research, there's many researchers here at the University of Minnesota who even show that kind of experience has devastating and long-lasting impacts on the well-being and health. So it's just like, I hope that we can move away from this and just go back to respect for human life,
right.
You know, and
I
made a comment a couple of nights ago where I was saying we can talk about policies and what policies we would like to be enacted under a Biden presidency, a Biden-Harris presidency. But I don't know about you, but it would be nice to be able to visit family once again. It would be nice to be able to hang out in person with friends. It would be nice to teach in person. And Trump has made it very clear in his administration and his sycophants who work for him have made it very clear that they've thrown in the white flag, that they have no intention to try to get a hold of, to get control of the virus. And for me, that's where it starts for me. Like, I would like to return to normal. I would like to not be stuck in my house 24/7. And Biden, if anything, he's made it quite clear that he's willing to defer to scientists. He's willing to put them at the helm. He understands and he recognizes the importance of science. And for me, that's where it starts. I want to return to normal. So this is my first year as a professor at Swarthmore.
This is it.
And I would have never imagined
amazing way teaching. To start teaching.
I would have never imagined that I would start my professor career teaching via Zoom. Like, this is not what I imagined. This is not why I got into the field. This is not one of the reasons I got into the field. I got into the field to interact directly with students in the flesh. And it just was, you know, another 4 years with Trump, I don't know how much the untold damage that would have come with respect just to the virus if he, you know, remained in office beyond January 20th.
Yeah, I mean, I think and so science me, that's generally... where it starts. Science generally mm-hmm. is a big issue, mm-hmm. obviously, for us as scientists. There's been, even before COVID, mm-hmm. you know, there was a lack of regard for science and, you know, funding of science and, you know, putting people in positions of power that didn't regard science or the work that we're trying to accomplish. So, I mean... I think that is a big deal for us as in our profession and as a society, because like we have to be able to understand the limitations of our own expertise. Like we might be experts in certain areas, but like we have to understand that other people know more and can advise us, and that like that's they have people's best interests at heart. Like these people that are working on COVID are doing it to try and literally save people's lives. And
no, what the right will say is, well, some people on the right, let me be clear, mm-hmm. some people on the right will say is, well, but Fauci was wrong about masks.
Well,
and I want to like scream
lack
at the television.
Understanding of how science
well,
works,
I want
though.
To scream at the television and say that's not the way science works. We make recommendations on the basis of the best available evidence.
Yeah.
And it would be more problematic if Fauci didn't switch his, if he didn't change his position on the basis of the data.
Right.
But he got new data, and like a good scientist, he updated his prior.
Right.
That's the way science works.
Yeah.
And I think Biden is acutely aware of that. Even if he himself is not a scientist,
right.
He is willing to put the relevant and qualified people with the relevant expertise at the helm. And that's exactly what we need. You cannot possibly know everything. That's right. Not the way this world works. The reason we collaborate on papers is because we cannot possibly know everything. You know, that's just not the way this works. And that's not how it should be anyway.
Yeah. We need to have, I think, you know, it speaks generally too to like, our need for like better education about scientific issues. Like, I don't know that we, you know, we're moving better in that direction and educating students about thinking like scientists and not just teaching mm-hmm. students facts about science, but actually teaching them the process of science and how that works. I think that right. that's just like definitely key, because that's what you're saying. Like we can make judgments, their best informed judgments based on the evidence we have right now, but especially in a complete unknown, like a pandemic that we've never experienced
before. It's a dynamic system. Dynamic systems are notoriously difficult to predict. You're predicting a dynamic system. It's difficult. And so, you know, yeah, so this is exactly, for me, this is as a scientist, as a developmental scientist, like it's critical that I have a president who has my best interest and the community's best interest at heart,
right?
Because yeah. it's science that is going to lead to progress, and it's ultimately science that's going to get us out of this predicament that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
And we, of course, don't have to be in this situation. I mean, look at other places. Other places have better handles on the virus than we do. So if it was an issue with the virus, then you would see the same rampant spread in other places.
Right. But
the mere fact that other places are doing better suggests that there is something that can be done. Mm-hmm. And this resigning to this deadly virus is exactly not what we need as a nation. I have a daughter that's about to be born. And I would love nothing more than for my mother to be able to drive, to fly down from Arizona to be able to see her. But even at this point, we're questioning whether or not she'll be able to come down just because of the virus. I'm not naive to think that the virus would have been eradicated under Biden,
no.
But at least I think we would be able to move more freely.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not the position we're in.
Yeah.
And even next semester, I was excited about the possibility of returning to in-person teaching next semester.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the case.
I'm not.
And I told Candy, Charisse, I'm an unconventional developmental psychologist in that I do a lot of computational modeling and computer programming. And so I was leaning toward teaching a computational modeling course, but it's a very intensive course that requires being in person in the flesh. Well, I had to sort of switch my plans last minute to teach an entirely different course because just of the pandemic. And I think that's unfortunate because I was really excited to teach computational modeling because that's actually something that our department is lacking and they need. And I have the skill set to provide it, but yet I'm stuck in this position.
Yeah, our students are suffering. Our students are suffering. So I think for everybody's well-being and trying to figure out how to get things under control and hopefully that's going to be our path forward because it's definitely needed.
And it doesn't hurt to have a woman of color.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
Like, I don't think people understand. Let me give people a living room credit. I just wish that people talked more about that fact. That's amazing. That is awesome. Regardless of whether you agree with her political views or the minutia, the very fact that she was able to ascend to the position that she's in. Yeah, it's vice president. She could, it would be nice for a woman to be president. But the very fact that she's able to ascend to that position is a testament to the fact that the system is working despite the inertia and despite the resistance. The system is working and the people have spoken. And today is his day of reckoning, and I think I'm just so passionate about this. I feel like Trump has forgotten who's in power. Trump has forgotten the reason he's there. It's because of the people. And we spoke and we fired him. That's the way it works in a democracy.
Let's have that final. Hopefully we have that final.
Here's hoping that today is the last day that we have to wonder. We'll see. Should things turn out the way they will, I'm sure we will see many "you're fired" memes.
And I hope other politicians are put on notice about what's happening. You can't say and do anything you want. We have the ultimate say. And there are consequences to your actions. So other politicians, be warned. This too could be your fate. Do not make your bed with the devil. It doesn't end well. But yeah, so I think what we should do is we should take a break. When we come back, we'll talk with Charisse about her work on infant individuation of faces and face-like stimuli. But yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for everybody sharing your thoughts. And
yeah.
Fingers crossed.
Yes, fingers crossed.
37 people dead, more than 1,300 injured, more than 4,000 arrested. Damage estimate, $200 million and rising. The man who's become the unwilling symbol of this outbreak of violence decided it was time to speak out.
Not right. I mean, we've got enough smog in Los Angeles. We'll be right back.
stuck here for a while.
Welcome back. In this segment, we're going to be talking about Dr. Charisse Pickron's work on infant individuation of faces by gender. But before we do that, I want to give Charisse the chance to talk about what got her into science, where she's from, why she chose developmental psychology as a field, as a career. And then I'll let her motivate her study, talk about the rationale behind the study, what she was ultimately looking at, whether or not she found it. And then we'll have a nice discussion about this really excellent and fantastic research. So, yeah. Hey,
thank you. So I'm originally from Amherst, Massachusetts. It's a small college town about an hour and a half west of Boston. And so I don't have the Boston accent, as some people ask me, oh, you don't have a Boston accent, you're from Massachusetts. But no.
I grew up in Rhode Island, and I don't have the accent, so I feel you.
Yeah. And I will attest that Rhode Islanders do have an accent, because I lived there for about a year when I did my postdoc at Brown. So yeah, they definitely have an accent.
I mean, I'm sure I have an accent, but it's not...
Well, everybody, technically everybody has an accent, but like,
right,
it's very
distinct. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I grew up in Amherst, and I went to undergrad at Mount Holyoke College, which is an all-women's school in South Hadley, Massachusetts. So in high school, I wanted to go somewhere in the South where it didn't snow. That was my, like, motivation to picking schools, is like, I don't want to be living anywhere where it snows. And then I ended up going to a school that was technically south of Amherst, but by like 3 miles, right? Like, so I stayed in Western Massachusetts for college. And after college, I did what maybe a lot of faculty and research institutions don't advise, which is I took a break from like critical thinking and did not do a research post-bac right away. Instead, I fulfilled one of my kind of lifetime dreams to intern at a dolphin assisted therapy program in Key Largo, Florida. And I can talk about that later at some point if we get
absolutely
to it.
Please talk about
like
that.
The coolest thing ever.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. And you know, I think obviously there's things to consider when we talk about animal assisted therapy and the welfare of animals in general. But this was a pretty incredible experience working with people who are all interested in child wellness and family wellness. So it was pretty incredible. I interned with social workers and physical therapists and educators, all interacting with dolphins. It's like pretty cool. And then I worked at Walt Disney World in Orlando, Florida for 2 years after. And then I got accepted into a post-baccalaureate research education program back at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where I interned for a year with Dr. Lisa Scott, who was recently on your podcast, and then applied to grad school and decided to stay at UMass to do my master's and my PhD in the developmental science within the psychology department at UMass. So that's a little bit about my background.
So you're pretty much a badass, and we should all bow down to you.
Right?
You have such an illustrious background.
Oh my goodness, and so many cool things.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think.
So now, were
just...
these fortuitous, like, were these fortuitous chances, or did you seek out these opportunities?
The post-college opportunities. So I found out about the dolphin assisted therapy kind of work at a high school college, or at a fair in high school for looking at colleges. And there was a school in Florida that said, hey, we have this program that you can learn about. And I was like, I want to do that. But then of course you had to be like 21. And so then I was waiting to be 21. And then I turned 21 and I was like, oh my gosh, I can now apply to this program. And so the organization is called Island Dolphin Care. In Key Largo, Florida. And so it was just something that it was on my bucket list,
and,
I'd say.
And
just,
there was no snow.
And there was no snow for, in my life for about 2 years straight. And of course, now as a postdoc in Minnesota,
I was just gonna say,
you get snow.
Yeah,
But it's also although Massachusetts actually can get more snow than Minnesota will.
Okay.
And
I'll have to update my prior.
The big difference, yes, be a good scientist and update. the biggest difference is the temperature. So my first year as a postdoc here was the polar vortex winter, where it was about minus 40 for a week. So that was cool.
Minus 40.
Yeah.
How do you even survive? Like, what did you
just stayed
don't
inside.
Go
yeah.
Don't
so
outside,
luckily, ever. Like things did cancel and get close, which was nice. But what I tell people that's the hardest thing I think here is even so if it's like -5 or -20, that's not really cold enough to cancel, right? Like -40 is when it gets cold enough to cancel, but not -10, 20 or so. So you really have to just, I think that the sentiment here is it's not bad weather, it's just bad clothing. So you have to just be able to wear the right amount of layers.
Wow.
And
a lot of layers.
Yeah. And I was prepared. My sister lived in Alaska for 5 years. So she gave me all the tips on like, this is what you need to wear to be okay in Minnesota.
my stepmom, she used to live for a little while in, I think, North Dakota, where she said that it was so cold that when you lived places, you had to like plug in your car so it didn't freeze overnight. Do you all have to do that? Is that a thing?
So I chose to find somewhere to live that had an indoor garage.
Nice.
So I just pay for that, and I don't have to worry about those things.
Get an automatic car starter too.
Yeah,
exactly.
Except those can be quite expensive, and if you're living on grad student salary, you're pretty,
I just always thought that was crazy.
So as a postdoc, you get like that, nice bump.
Right. I felt like I was rich when I became a postdoc. I thought I'm making $1,000 a year. Wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Living large, yeah.
I can buy 2 pairs of shoes.
Well, wonderful. Yeah. And so now you're in Minnesota. You're enjoying your negative degree weather. And tell us a little bit about then the research that you do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess I've always been interested and enjoyed working with children. Prior to joining Dr. Scott's lab as a postdoc and then continuing in grad school, I had a lot of work just with 3 to 5 year olds, and that was like one of my favorite age ranges because there's just the imaginative play, the lack of a filter. I mean, just all of it. It seems so exciting.
They are so the best. They're the best to have in the lab.
You know, one of the things I said to Dr. Scott when I first joined her lab was like, babies make me nervous. Like, I'll be honest, I don't know much about babies.
Nope.
They make me kind of nervous. I really like that 3 to 5 age range. But very quickly, I learned and had this experience to see how incredible infancy is and just the amount of information that they're taking in and processing and learning and then growing. And from day to day, there's changes. I mean, I don't have any kids myself yet, but, doing any sort of like longitudinal study just in 3 months, we had them come in at 6 months and they came back at 9 months and it was like completely different person.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So infancy is just a really incredible time of change and development and, which in some ways is definitely informing the kind of research questions I'm interested in.
Yeah.
So, really generally, what's exciting to me is this idea of trying to understand the way experiences in the 0 to 3 time range is shaping and the growth and learning. Mm-hmm. And so whether that's experience with primary caregivers, your environment, larger community and all of the interconnected bi-directional relationships that happen at those different levels. So, I like the dynamic systems. We talked about that earlier. I'm a big fan of dynamic systems. And, so my work and introduction to infant-related science was really driven from this experience starting out in grad school. And so it's just a really incredible time that there's growth in cognition, there's growth in brain, you know, your brain is changing.
Motor system, right.
So
language.
Like,
so much.
Exactly.
Even in, like,
so,
babies, infants don't speak, but, like, you know, they're, you know, crying follows certain prosodic patterns. Like, there's
exactly.
lots to be learned. I absolutely yeah. agree. I mean, I'm biased, clearly. We're all biased, clearly.
Yeah.
I'm like Charisse. I'm like, I'm terrified of babies. They scare me. I love them. They're adorable. But I was like, oh my God, research with babies. We always had in our lab, we were always like pretty much like a three and up lab.
Sure.
And in my last couple years, one of my other graduate students, Dr. Stephanie Miller, who's at Ole Miss now, she did her dissertation with, I think they were like, I want to say 18 and 20 month olds ish, something in that range. And boy, when she had them in the lab, I was like, oh, other room. I'm going to the other room. Oh. Like, you can hear them crying. And I'm like, oh, Stephanie's mm-hmm. testing somebody. And I'm like, oh,
yeah.
I don't know. It's like so hard to keep a 3-year-old on task. And I'm like, having babies and all the things that come along with it. I know it's so challenging for researchers with all the things
yeah.
that come along with
yeah.
it. It's so rewarding. And the wonderful things that you get to see and the growth that you observe. So,
right. And so the other, I think, cool things that has shaped my research is that, you know, I went through a really, I started out working with Dr. Scott, and it was really incredible and very formative experience. But then, you know, life happens, and Dr. Scott had to move to Florida and start her, you know, continue her career there. And so I had to make a really hard decision about, do I stay? Do I go? And ultimately, I decided to stay. And, you know, I've maintained my working relationship with Dr. Scott, which is great. But I switched into this more cognitive focused infant lab, working with Dr. Eric Charisse. And so he and that process, although it was difficult, was gave me an opportunity to then dive into another literature, another way of thinking and asking about infancy. And so now that's why I like to kind of think about my interest as this intersection of perceptual development and sociocognitive related development, and being able to look at that from behavioral mechanisms, but also measures of eye movement and brain activity and things like that. So I think at the time was really hard to decide what to do, but then ultimately, it gives me a broader way of thinking about things. So that for the research that we're going to talk about was a part of my dissertation.
Mm.
And, you know, taking this idea that we know that in infancy, in the first year of life, that infants are becoming experts at processing the faces that they have most amount of experience with, and they see the most, that they hear the names most frequently paired with, right? And so, but how does that translate to what they're maybe conceptualizing or representing about those kinds of faces and the way the faces differentiate? Is that at all something that is, you know, coming online in the first year or two of life? And so that's kind of how I started to integrate these different ideas with the guidance and a lot of support from Dr. Charisse is this developing this dissertation related to cognitive kind of question of distinguishing among faces.
Right.
Yeah. This is a super interesting paper. I really enjoyed reading about it. As always, I remind our listeners that if you haven't noticed already, my expertise is not in infancy. So I love reading infant research to get more of an idea of like the creative ways that you assess things in infants. So this one, do you want to give a little bit of just background about like the study itself and a little overview of what you did and what you found?
Yeah. So this is a part of my dissertation. So there are actually kind of there are three big parts to that dissertation. And so far I've published kind of one chunk of it. And so we're asking this question about kind of a concept of individuation, which for a long time for me was really hard to grasp the difference between. In perceptual face processing, a lot of times we talk about, oh, infants can tell the difference between two faces. And in some ways, we use the terminology of individuating between these two faces, right? So we show face A and B side by side, and we want to know, do infants look differently at them? where now I'm in this kind of cognitive infant lab where we use the word individuation in a different way, where we think about do infants represent or see face A as a distinct individual that is constant across time and space, that is separate from another, you know, face B? Or is it that infants are kind of representing face A and B as kind of the same individual, but just superficially changing information, the superficial visual information on their faces?
Sure.
And so it was a bit of an abstract kind of twist for me to really start to grasp at that. So that's kind of what we were,
yeah, just a quick question. So when you say, you know, so you make the distinction between two different conceptualizations of individuation. So on the one hand, you can use something like paired preference, which is what you described.
Yep.
But on the other hand, the question is, and this seems like what you're more interested in now, or at least this is what the study is about, is whether or not they see an individual as constant through space and time, irrespective of facial expressions, for example,
right,
or sort of superficial. So that's what you mean. So I could be smiling or I could be frowning. And the question is, does the infant perceive me as the same thing, despite the fact that those two instances are perceptually distinct?
Right.
They could tell the difference, quote unquote, between these two faces, but still perceive them as being one entity.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And one of the ways that we can test that is this individuation concept or task. And one of the really important differences between some of the, like the visual paired comparison task that we were just talking about versus the individuation task that I was using for this project is that in the paired comparison task, you're presenting both at the same time in the same space. So there's spatiotemporal like overlap. And so we know that three-month-olds can individuate those two faces because they're side by side, right? Like, there's two separate individuals.
They can't possibly be the same exact entity because they are both there separate from one
another.
Side
by side.
I guess the question, though, I guess I would push back on it slightly. I would say the mere existence of spatial temporal cues doesn't necessarily indicate that the faces are distinct or the same. So you have to be using something above and beyond that cue to individuate the faces. But yes, I generally agree.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess saying that there's two identities, or not so much identities, but two items that are existing side by side, right? Whereas in the test that I used, it was we never showed infants the objects at the same time. So we took away the spatial temporal information so that each individual item was showed sequentially. And so in that, now we're asking, if they see face A, and then that's taken away from them, they no longer see it, and then they see something else in front of them, do they think that is face B, or is that face A just with a different appearance?
Sure.
Right? Do they think that it's the same individual, but just kind of with this fluid appearance? And so we think about that and describe that as kind of a kind-based individuation, where kind concepts is something that goes deeper than what's necessarily observable. So if we say, so I'm looking at the two of you right now, and we all three of us have a lot of differences, hair, skin, eyes, shapes of our facial features, but we all represent the kind human, right? Whereas we might be able to find some objects in the environment that share some superficial feature similarities. Remember, maybe like I have something that has also wearing like black on top and light on the bottom or something like that. But that object, although may share perceptual commonalities with myself, does not share this more deeper meaning that links us to human versus non-human. Right? And so that's what we start to talk about in terms of this kind categorization. And we use the task of kind-based individuation to tap into whether infants are representing these faces or objects in a way that's a little bit more deeper than the superficial information.
Could you, since we read your wonderful paper,
yeah.
And could you, I know this is probably especially hard because this is a podcast and so you cannot provide visual aids, right. But could you walk a listener or listeners through, like, what does this task look like when you bring a baby into the lab so they can have a sense of what happens in the study?
Yeah, yeah, I'll do my best here.
I know. It's like for everyone, we'll put a link to the paper. There is a nice diagram in there for you.
Right. But. Yeah. So one thing that is really, I think, cool about this type of task, before I get into the details, is that it's what you describe as like a tabletop kind of task. So I can take it pretty much anywhere, just put it in a bag and go. And that actually afforded me opportunities to bring my science out of the lab space and into areas where we would have more opportunities to engage with families of a diverse background. Yeah. So when I started my postdoc here at the University of Minnesota at the Institute of Child Development, I actually had an opportunity to engage with the Minnesota Children's Museum. Of course, this is pre-COVID, and was one of the first scientists to do a research project in their museum. Awesome. And it was this task. And as a result, we were able to have kind of equal number of children of color versus white children in one subsection of the project. So the paper that we're going to mostly focus on doesn't have that nice balance, but it's a really cool process where you can just bring it and go. So the way it looks like is we have a box that is like a black cardboard box, and it's got a little, there's an opening in the front, and then unbeknown to the infants, there's an opening in the back. So there's this kind of tricky magic trick piece to it. And we have what we do and what you don't learn right away, or what they don't tell you before you start grad school, especially in an infant lab, and in a behavioral infant lab, is you have to be good at arts and crafts. Like that is, and that's, I break out in hives if I have to do arts and crafts, right? Like this is not something that comes natural to me, despite the fact that my mom is a preschool teacher and a paraprofessional who is very crafty, and my sister is.
You have to get RAs who are creative.
Exactly. Yeah, so that was one of the pieces I would ask them on their interview is, how good are you at arts and crafts?
I have a scrapbooking suitcase, if that gives you any like background of how much crafting I do. So like I
right. So we've got this box. It's got an opening in the front and the back, and then we printed out 3-inch tall pictures of different people. So we used actual people, we printed them out and then put them on these layers of foam core material. So we basically have a 3-inch tall face, and that is on either side of this kind of inch deep core. So it's something that you can grab like a block, right? So it's basically putting a picture of a face on a block. And then we go through a series where we have the infant and the experimenter sitting at the table. I will either show them one face come out of the box, and I show that to the infant and allow them to see it for 10 seconds. I put that back inside the box and then invite them to reach in and discover. So in this case, one item was shown, one item went back in, and then the babies are succeeding at finding one item. Now, the other trials that we have are involve two items. And this is kind of the tricky part here. So now what I have is the box. I take one item out. So face A comes out of the box. I show the baby, put it back in. And then I take face B out of the box and show the baby, put that back in. We bring the box forward, and the magic trick happens where I take one of those two faces out of the back of the box without the baby seeing. So the babies are succeeding at finding something. They find one of the faces inside that box. But if they were to reach back in and keep looking, they will not find the second face. And so here's this critical piece to kind of our dependent measure of reaching duration is, are infants reaching inside the box? Are they looking for the second face more so than if they only saw one face go in and out of the box? And so we use terminology of, we describe it as being an expected or unexpected outcome. Now, of course, I'm using an adult kind of concept of expectation, which I think can be sometimes, sometimes kind of grapple with that as part of the way we talk about the research. But the idea would be that if the infant has individuated face A from face B, they should expect there to be two items inside the box, right? And so when they only find one, it's unexpected, and thus it's a violation of their expectations, so they will reach longer inside of the box. And so we do this, eight or so times over and over again, where we can then get an average reaching duration and compare the unexpected reaching duration to the expected reaching duration. So that's the task itself. And so what I did in this paper is we had prior research has shown that 10-month-old infants can do this type of individuation with a human, a doll face versus a inverted doll face or a non-human image. Mm-hmm. So the first thing we kind of wanted to do is just replicate that general finding with our infants. So the infants that I was working with was roughly around 11 to 12 months and then roughly around 24 months. So give or take a few months on either end, right? Mm-hmm. And, what we first found is that both the, 1-year-olds and the 2-year-olds, essentially, were individuating the human versus the non-human, although there's some caveats to those findings, but that's kind of broadly speaking what we found. And then we found that the 2-year-olds, the 24-month-old infants, were individuating male from female faces, but the 11 to 12 month olds were not really showing this robust ability, which I'm sure we'll dig a little bit more into, but I'll take a pause. Absolutely. There just to go over that was the main task itself.
No, yeah, that's really helpful. I had one other question though, Charisse, about so what you describe is like that first trial where one item goes into the box, the infant reaches in, they pull out one item.
Right.
So this is that first situation where when they're searching again, maybe expected to be empty, then you do this, right, what you described with the two faces. But there's also this other one where
expected,
so you have
empty,
like,
final.
Surreptitiously,
yeah,
removed the,
yep,
one, but
yep,
then eventually you show that being
in,
pulled out, and then they search again for this like final, what should be again,
yeah,
expected to be empty, because now they have seen both of those items come out of the box. Could you tell us a little bit about, like, what's with that trial?
Yeah.
Also, can you comment on whether or not that's... So we were... Candy and I were having a conversation through text last night, and we couldn't figure out whether or not that was meant to be a control trial. And if it was a control trial, what is it controlling for? It wasn't clear to us. So maybe,
right,
you can make that clear. Yeah.
Yeah. So that... I will be honest. Like, that was something that my advisor, Dr. Charisse, and I, like, went...
When
back
in
and
doubt,
forth.
Blame the advisor.
That's my dissertation advisor's fault. No.
It's his fault. Right.
Totally. So we went back and forth on this idea of, like, do we, what's a common practice in the literature? Yeah. Do people include it, not include it in the analyses? Why do we have this? And so the idea, though, is that, we do want to show that there was something else there, like showing them, yes, there were two items. Here's this other one. We played a trick on you, but now we have this actually. So the experimenter then takes out that missing second face. And so then, like you said, we call it this expected empty final, where now both items have gone out, and the infant has the final opportunity to reach in the box. And the idea would be that the reaching time should be roughly kind of equivalent to the reaching time during the one face expected outcome, because there's not really any kind of reason or rationale for them to explore the box anymore, because now it's completely empty. That being said, some people have kind of pushed back to say, Well, now they're just confused. Now they don't know what is going on.
Magical, actually. So right. this is what we were talking about. So we're called, and this is something this is a point you raise, which is a very important point that we grapple with in the infant literature, which is we apply these adult concepts or these terms to stimuli that infants may not perceive that way. And so you're calling this event expected, but based on my reading of the event, it appears quite magical. And so I can easily see an infant, especially an older one, sort of realizing or reasoning that, well, when I reached into the box, there wasn't anything, but now they've reached into the box, so maybe this is some kind of magic trick.
And also,
it makes a prediction that wasn't necessarily borne out in the data. The prediction is that you should actually show longer reaching during the expected final than you do. Well, if you perceive it as magical, and right. I'm like, I see you reach into the box maybe and you pull out something that I wasn't able to pull out. Reach into the box and I'm able to pull out. So what I was going to say is, if they perceive it that way, that I'm reaching into the box and you're pulling out something that I wasn't able to pull out, then it's sort of like, well, let me try again. And I'm going to keep mm-hmm. searching because they clearly were successful. And so it right. makes a prediction that necessarily wasn't true in your data. So I'm not too worried about that. I had to go back and look at it again. But still, it's a strange event.
I think it depends a lot on perception, though, right? Because then
right.
the other option is like, oh, well, I saw two items go in. One came out. I know that one should be in there. I searched and didn't find it, but like, oh, this adult did. That's also probably right. a common experience for children, that they try to do something and are not successful that an adult can successfully do for them. So there's probably just a lot of like, who knows how babies interpret it.
Yeah, exactly. That. And so, right. Yeah. And that's the other piece to it is that their reaching time. Still, the main question is, are they reaching more yeah. to that unexpected event? And if they are, then that is really suggesting to us that they are representing those two items as distinct individuals. And what we don't know is, like, what is the information? What are they using to make that distinction?
Sure. Yeah.
Obviously, that's still an open question. Right. So that expected empty final, some people will just actually average it across the expected outcome. And that to me felt a little odd because there are different series of events happening before those two types of trial outcomes. So we left it separately. With the main interest and the main comparison is really between the unexpected and the expected.
Right.
Outcomes. But yes, that is definitely something to think about, is what's going on with that final expected empty piece.
I wouldn't be too worried about that, only because the account that I described makes a prediction that isn't borne out in the data.
Yeah.
And so right. maybe that's true in other samples, but at least it wasn't true in this sample.
Yeah. I mean,
so it appears to us to be a magical trick, but it doesn't seem like that's the way infants perceived it, just based on their reaching duration.
Yeah. I was more just interested in, like I said, like what it was supposed to represent, because I wasn't sure if it was like what you said now makes sense of having, like, you know, trying to compare maybe different, you know, expected empty situations.
Right.
But knowing that what we can maybe draw as a conclusion from that one isn't quite as clear because we're not sure how infants are perceiving it. I also thought it might have been something about just like over time to show that, like, it's not like the more times that you present the box to infants, they just keep reaching for longer durations.
Sure. No.
So,
and you know, the other piece is also that we're now showing them, like, the box is totally like we showed you these events and now the events are done, right? Like, we're coming to a close of this
for another trial.
Yeah. And now we're going to move on to something else. Right.
Sure.
So that's the other piece, is that we're kind of giving some like closure, I guess, right, to the series of events that we've shown them this information.
Sure.
But I do, you know, I do recognize that that can be, there's a lot of ways that we can think about and maybe, you know, try to dig a little bit more into that piece. And so I will say this task has been used to also evaluate infants, understanding of like numbers and number of items that are involved in an event. That's another way you can kind of think about this. And so they've used this with comparing different kinds of objects. And so the kind of nuance that I was asking is like, okay, we know that faces are really important. And we know that in infancy, in the first year of life, like different kind of ways that we can categorize faces, different types of facial information that are socioculturally relevant, given that this study was done in the U.S. But where does that kind of line up in terms of meaningful representation, you know, in childhood? And so this was like this initial attempt to bridge this idea of perceptual sensitivity and expertise with when do we see, you know, at 3 to 5, 7 years of age, you see this essentialist reasoning with the idea that there's something, there's an essence that groups different individuals together that are meaningful to the core. And so where does that start to, does kind-based individuation potentially lay a foundation for later emerging essentialist reasoning about categories of people?
Now, so this work is super intriguing. And so I have lots of questions and we won't be able to cover all of those questions. But one question I have is that sort of struck me as odd is the fact that the 12-month-old in the face versus the female versus male face condition,
right,
they didn't show, at least in their reaching, any individuation. The reason that strikes me as surprising is because we know from quite early on that babies have this bias to process female faces in particular. And that, right, and so if that, to the extent that that's true, you would actually predict, I would think, that if that's true and that carries itself all the way through to 12 months of age, that they should be able to individuate those faces on the basis of the fact that they're experts in female faces. So anything, so you're basically comparing to a prototype. It's not prototype-like, so therefore I individuate. And so it was surprising to me to see this lack of individuation in 12-month-olds, just given what we know about infants' early emerging biases to process female faces.
Right.
And so I was hoping perhaps that you'd be able to maybe help me understand. I mean, I guess part of it may have to do with the measure itself.
Right. So now we're adding in this task demand, right?
Right. And so perhaps that is. And so I guess the question is, to the extent that's true, then I would be curious to see how these 12-month-olds, because you can certainly do a visual paired preference task with a 12-month-old. It's a little bit more difficult because they're more, you know, active. But it's still possible. And so I would be interested in whether or not in a visual paired test, they would actually show the individuation. So the way it would work, I would think, is you would familiarize them to one face, to the male face, for example. And then that test literally just give them pair the female face next to the male face. It's a simple discrimination test. And so you would at least expect that, at least in that context, they should show a discrimination. And so it's hard for me to interpret what's the meaning of their lack of individuation, I guess, at 12 months of the female and male faces? That's kind of the question. I mean, it's kind of a question, but
So it's not so much, we're not saying that they like fail at seeing the two faces, seeing faces differently, right? So we, like you just said, I mean, there's a lot of literature out there that says that infants are able to discriminate among male faces and female faces, and they show a visual preference to female if they're primarily raised by females, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and there's like that one study by Dr. Paul Quinn who had a great group of infants raised by males, primarily males, and so they showed a male face preference, right? So we see that. And so in this case here, we're not necessarily saying that they can't see a difference between the two faces, but does that difference really matter to them in this context or is it just that the male face and the female face are just swapping and it's still the same object? It's still the same entity that is existing. It just has this fluid change to it. And to us, that seems really like a strange thing to be thinking about, right? But I think that's what this task is trying to tap into, is whether not so much can they see the difference, but does that difference have meaning to it? Does that difference indicate that those distinctions represent individual people or individual objects?
Right.
So we have like examples from, you know, object literature where it's like a yellow duck and a yellow truck. And if they're both yellow, but by a certain age, a duck and a truck are still seen as distinct individuals because one, as an adult, I see one as a truck and the other is an animal. So one's an animal, one's not an animal, right? So you have that kind of kind-based representation despite the superficial information. In contrast, you also see if you have, for an infant, if we show them, like, say, the idea would be, like, if we showed an infant a wine glass and a sippy cup, those are very different visually, and they can see the differences, but they might just represent that as something, as cup. Like, if we were to give them that word and say, it's just a cup, it has different features, but it's a cup. So that's kind of, again, we're asking this idea here with faces, is we know that we now are showing evidence that, like, infants have this superordinate representation of human versus non-human as distinct kinds. And we know that now, okay, like, you can see side by side a male and a female face are different, but does that mean anything in some way to the infant? And so that's what we're trying to tap into. But we're not, what I want to be clear is that we're not interpreting this as evidence that babies at 2 years of age have a concept of gender, right? Like, I'm saying individuation based on face gender, that's a very adult interpretation of it. But yeah, what we're showing is that there's something about a male face and there's something about a so-called female face that is meaningful, that shows distinctions that are meaningful, that say to an infant, this is a different kind of face than this other thing is. So there are two different kinds of people being represented.
Do you think that part of this also, so in my reading, I was sort of thinking about, like, how perceptually different some of the stimuli are. So again, for listeners, they're in your trials that are human versus non-human faces, they're sort of these, like, a blob that's shaped like a head with shapes on where a face would be. And versus, like, the male and female faces are both pictorial stimuli of, you know, real faces. And, like, do you think that part of the like, starker contrast perceptually between a male and a female face, which, like, they do have differences, obviously, but, like, just in glancing at the stimuli, it's, like, it seems like such a starker contrast between a human face and that non-human face, and that sort of is easier to remember in a way? Like, does memory demands play into this? And perhaps that's why you see these younger infants, they do individuate human versus non-human, but once we get to male and female, even though if you have them side by side, yes, they could tell a difference, right? They could visually attend differently, but they're so similar that putting into that also a memory demand, maybe that is playing some role in it. Do you think that's...
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely memory demand in this task, and I think that's a great point. I will say that, you know, we... In this task, we're allowing the infants time to manipulate and look at the objects they find. So, you know, I could potentially see if this was like a rapid presentation, you know, 1 second of seeing that face, and maybe that kind of the robust differences perceptually between the shaped blobs and the human faces versus a male and a female could come into play more so than I think it is here, because they're allowed to look at them the same amount of time across all the different trials, right? So they have access to manipulate and play and look at, you know, those faces. And so I, you know, and I guess one way to think about it is, like, sure that maybe the male and female faces are a little bit more subtly different from one another. But those subtle differences, obviously they can see them, right? At least the research says they can see them.
Sure.
But again, we're going back to the question, is that difference meaningful to
them? Right, yeah.
Right, so I guess, you know, I'm not really sure if it's really driven by the fact that it's a subtle difference versus these, like, really obvious kind of obtuse differences.
I think about it from, and I don't know, always with the caveat that I don't study infants. So I just think about this from in some of the work that we did in our lab with older children, and this is what we see in adults, is this idea of, like, an isolation effect, that, like, objects that are a stark difference in a category of objects are often remembered more. So, like, and I know there's only like two objects in this case, so maybe that doesn't completely apply, but the idea that like these two objects are so much more perceptually different from one another, whereas these male and female ones, maybe that gets lost in my memory because they were not as, you know, they weren't as a stark contrast as...
At the minimum, you would at least need a control trial. Yeah. I think to really get at this question...
That's the problem, trying to get things that are conceptually different but very perceptually similar is, like, it's very...
No. So, here, right. So, I think the control you would need here to answer that question definitively is what she's doing, which is she's having them search for male and female faces, but to make them more perceptually distinct. Mm. And so, Charisse made a good point, which is that, oh, you know, they were able to play with the toys or play with these faces for the same amount of time. Well, that doesn't itself control for the fact that there's still a stronger perceptual difference when you compare faces versus non-faces compared to two female and male faces.
Right.
And so again, I don't think that giving them equal amounts of time would help to address this issue. I think you would almost need a control trial where you make the faces more distinct.
Ooh, or the opposite.
But it's hard to quantify distinct.
Have you ever done ones, Charisse, or other research where, what about like presenting two faces of the same category? So like two different female faces.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep. And I think that's definitely a direction to take. So two things I just want. One is circling back is that.
Sorry, you know, we're for just the two. Rapid so, firing no, no, no. It's okay.
Yeah, no, this is great. I'm having so much fun doing this. But like, so, you know, like the piece, though, I think is, again, that we do see this in the two-year-olds, that now that subtle difference is important in some way, right? So that is the other piece to really be thinking about is, like, now there's some subtleties that they are keying into, but they don't necessarily, and yes, like, infants' vision is still developing, right? That's continuing to mature into childhood. But I don't know necessarily if there's evidence to say, like, that a vision of a one-year-old and a two-year-old is going to be so different that, like, those subtle differences aren't picked up, more so than, like, now those subtle differences are important and they're remembering them as a two-year-old. But so that was just one other thing I wanted to think about. And then getting at this idea, okay, what do we use as a control, right? So I think, yeah, you're really raising this really important point about... So if we were to show a Sarah and a Vanessa or something like that, where it's like two different female identities, and that's an open question. Like I haven't done that yet, where we say, you know, we have two females, Sarah and Vanessa, and they come in and out of the box. Now, they could still individuate based on identity, mm-hmm. right? Or they might not, because it's a female is a female, and that's the way to go. So that would be the question there is, are they seeing Sarah and Vanessa as Sarah and Vanessa, or are they seeing that just as, here's Sarah, object one, and then, oh, that object now changes to slightly different features, but it's still a female, so it's probably the same identity or same individual. So yeah, I think that's something I would definitely, I want to follow up on and test. And I think, you know, so I think one of the other questions that had come up, and I think this might be a nice time to bring it in, is the actual stimuli that we used. Mm-hmm. So we actually started out with computer-generated faces. So we used a program, FaceGen, that has started to be, I think, more commonly used both in developmental work, but in just psychology work in general, because we wanted to get at let's try to control as much as possible. So we take a face that's the same identity, but then in that program, you can switch it to being more male looking based on their algorithm of defining maleness. And then we can take the same face identity and switch it to female, so-called female like identity. Right. And so we did that and we ended up with these bald thing, like peach colored, you know, faces. And, you know, the other piece is that we actually were doing both a manual search task, which is what we're talking about, and we also did a puppet show version of this kind of task, which looking time, as Dan, you mentioned, is really hard the older the infants get. Like, it's not as a useful kind of measure. Really,
it's because they just don't sit still.
They don't sit still, and there's better ways to get at it, such as a manual search test. So anyway, so we started out with these faces, and, you know, to me, like, yeah, there's a male face and there's a female face. But let me tell you, the number, I mean, like, I have now gotten used to kind of making babies cry, right? Like, that's kind of the name of the game. It makes me sound like a horrible human being. We just started talking in this whole episode on, like, humility and kindness. And I'm like, yeah, I made, like, three babies cry today. Oh, well, right? So, right. I mean, like, I no longer feel so badly about them crying.
Freaked out by these freaky faces?
Yes. Let me tell you, these were not things that babies wanted to see, interact with. Like, it was just, I mean... Yeah, so we kind of we piloted with these things, and we wanted to, and this
it's
is
sort of interesting, actually. But you also the fact that they respond that way is kind of interesting.
I mean,
because this is
really
a rich
cool,
interpretation.
Actually.
Well, so I was gonna say this is a rich interpretation of the data, of course. So I don't know if this is the case, but it at least suggests tentatively that they have a prototype of human faces, and sort of this thing is completely unhuman-like. Yeah, I don't know what that is. Please get that away from me.
Right. I mean, this that uncanny valley.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
Phenomenon. So it could be that. No, again, like, there are other studies, other development. I mean, even in the lab that I was doing, in Dr. Cherry's lab, that we were doing, using these faces in other capacities, and it wasn't an issue. So we use them in other ways, but I don't know if it was the fact that they're sitting in a dark room watching a puppet show and there are these, like, bald faces coming out at them or what exactly it was. But also, because we could control everything, you know, like, again, like, Dr. Therese and I were just like, let's be super controlled experiment, right? But now here, this is an example of, like, in science, like, well, especially in infant and developmental work, we have to go from, like, what's super controlled and, like, good science, and then what's kind of ecologically valid, and what's, like, something that kids are going to get through the task, right? Like, so now here's a decision we have to kind of make. And so we piloted, and we weren't really seeing kind of very strong effects in any direction, really. Whether it was due to the fact that some of the infants, like, really just did not want to participate and look at them, and then, like, there were other kids who got through it, but just
inside,
like,
inside that dark box, to get, like, that creepy bald head that you put in there,
you know. And so, I mean, some perceptual work shows, like, you know, really young infants being able to show female face bias is really driven by hair, like having a hairline and having some information about hair. So we decided to go with these actual human faces, and you know, one comment I got from one of my dissertation committee members was like, well, listen, like, my faces we use, primarily all the women have longer hair, and we kind of purposely chose that. Like, we chose faces from this face data set that were kind of very stereotypical male, so-called female, where, like, the females had longer hair. And so the question is, well, would we still get the effects if, like, all the women and all the men, if men had long hair and the women had short hair, or, I mean, I will say that,
Or the same length hair.
Yeah. We did have, in this paper, we had a group of infants who saw, male and Caucasian male and female faces, or white male and female faces, but then we also had another set of infants who saw black male and female faces, right? And so we kind of averaged across that. And with the black faces that we were using, the females, there was more variability in length of hair for the black females that were coming out of the face data set. So that even though their hair was longer than the male faces, it wasn't as long for all of those faces. Right. Now, I think this is something that we really would need to dig into, is, like you said, like, if they have the same length hair, or if the men had longer hair and the women had short hair, you know, those are definitely things that we could consider. And is hair the key defining feature that they're then saying these are meaningful distinctions? Right. Or is it really a combination of all these other pieces that are about a face? What is it about the face that is meaningful to these 2-year-olds?
Yeah. So I actually had a question about that related to this idea. But what you just said made me think that, you know, I think you're right. You would need to control the length of hair, because at this point, it's hard to know whether or not the distinction, the difference in reaching is due to just differences in hair length. And of course, that's not what you want to conclude. You want to say that they're making, you know, kind-based distinctions. Another sort of something I was thinking about when I was reading the paper is that it's nice that you're using real human faces. You know, so it's nice because it makes the stimuli more ecologically valid. But the problem, of course, as you raise, is that the more ecologically valid and rich the stimuli become, the harder it becomes to know what exactly they're using to discriminate the face. And so the question I have for you is that, well, the 24-month-old, they showed reliable differences between these two test trials. And a question I guess I have is, how do we know that this difference, that is that infant, the 24-month-olds are showing a kind-based discrimination as opposed to just discriminating objects per se? And I agree with you. I will say with the caveat, I agree with you that I'm not impressed by this idea that perhaps one of the differences is that the 24-month-olds have better visual processing than 12-month-olds. I mean, there's no reason to suspect that there's any differences. So that probably is not driving the effect. But I guess to me, the more interesting question is, how do we know that their sort of increased reaching to the unexpected empty trial for the male-female faces is driven by a kind-based discrimination as opposed to them just seeing these two things as different objects? I recognize that there's two things in the box. I go to reach for the second time and I can't seem to find it. Where is that second thing? Not necessarily where is that second female or where is that second male?
Sure.
So yeah. I guess how do we disentangle between or distinguish between those two interpretations of the data?
Yeah. So I said before, like, we're not saying that they have this idea of maleness and femaleness. Like, we can't speak, our data doesn't speak to that, right?
But even two different kinds, though, how do we know that their reaching simply didn't, it's possible that their reaching was just driven by the fact that they remember that there's two instances in the box, regardless of the identity of those instances.
Reduced to number, right?
Exactly, like, number.
Reduced
right,
to number exactly. Versus kind.
Yeah.
Sure.
Versus kind, exactly. That's exactly what
I'm saying. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's definitely a hard question to kind of think about. And I think, I don't know if you can, in terms of kind of thinking about what is a kind, is that the way the test is set up is, so we have two objects presented, but they're two different things, right? Mm-hmm. So like the kind concept idea is that there's something about this one object that has, a distinction that doesn't allow it to morph into the other object, right? So even if we're just talking about it as two objects, where those two objects can't fluidly morph into one another. So they are kind of distinct kinds of objects.
Yeah. I think, so I'm thinking about this. This is a difficult question to answer probe, but there's got to be a way to get at this. And I think one approach, in addition to what you have here, I'm sure you've heard of the sequential touching paradigm, like Mandler's sequential touching paradigm. So she gives them a whole bunch of toys, and the toys come from two different categories. You can have vehicles and animals, or vehicles and people. And the idea is, if they systematically touch items from one category more than they do from another category, then you have reason to think that they're
in an order,
categorizing these two instances differently. Now, that's probably where you want to stop in terms of your interpretation, but at least you have some reason to think that they're treating these two things differently. And so you have to wonder whether or not would this be the right way of going about getting at whether or not they're perceiving these two instances as kind-based instances that are distinct? Like, would something like a sequential touching paradigm do a better job at getting at that? Because again, I think, Candy's exactly right. She said it more elegantly than I was able to say it. Like, the question that I'm ultimately asking is the discrimination due to number or discrimination due to kind? And I wonder whether something like sequential touching would do a better job or better approximate kind representation.
I don't know, though, because I think that with
I don't know.
I think that I with know. Those pair, this is funny because Dion, you remember me texting you a while ago when I'm teaching about like categorization in my class and I really want to know more about this. And so I was trying to like read some more of that literature. And I feel like it always comes down to the same type of issue.
Perceptual features.
Yeah. Yep. It's just that it's very hard to say, like, if I present two objects, like if you're, because in some way, even a conceptual category is typically linked to some perceptual feature. Like that's what makes a category. So it's so difficult to parse those apart. Like I think your example actually with cups was one of my favorite ones I've heard so far, is because like you would really have to find objects that are very perceptually distinct, but somehow conceptually related. And to really try and get at some of this difference, because that it just always seems to come down to that, like whether it's, well, that vehicles don't have legs, but animals do, or, these different studies are looking at, it's a challenge.
Well, this is where you purposely confound the stimuli. This is exactly one of the, so I don't know if you've read David's stuff, his earlier stuff in 98. This is exactly what the question he was asking. So he was, interested in this Mandler finding, whereby the 14-month-olds showed more systematic touching to animals versus vehicles. And she argued that this is a conceptual distinction that they're making, that you have animals on the one hand and vehicles on the other. Well, David took a look at the research and he sort of argued, well, another difference is that animals have legs, vehicles don't. So if this is truly a kind-based conceptual representation that they're coming up with, then what you at the very minimum would have to do is give both things legs. If they treat both categories distinct, despite the fact that there's this sort of perceptual similarity between both categories, then you have more reason to think that perhaps what they formed is a conceptual representation. We can never be certain, but at least I think that's one way of going about this. And so in some way, I guess, to draw an analogy, you would almost have to make the stimuli, make them all bald or something. But again, the infants treat those as sort of like weird looking things, and they should, as they should. They're weird looking.
Yeah, I mean, that's even the same with David's. Like, the cars that have legs on them, and it's like, I don't really
know what that is.
I mean, there's evidence that, like, function is another kind of way that infants are kind, like, using kind categories, right? Or also animacy. So, you can take a butterfly or worm and either show them that the butterfly moves on its own, in terms of creating visual magic, right? The butterfly moves on its own, or the butterfly is being pushed by a person's hand. Then they individuate the butterfly, right? They individuate the idea of animacy as a kind of category, that even though it's a butterfly, if I show it moving by itself, that's a different kind of thing than something than when it's being pushed by another agent.
Similar to Jonathan's poke the cat, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
One of the other kind of things I wanted to bring up, although unfortunately our data doesn't help this argument, I guess, in the way is, in terms from the object individuation literature, there's some kind of evidence and argument that labels and language, noun word knowledge, drives this kind-based individuation of objects. So when infants have when parents report that their baby has the word duck and truck, those infants seem to also show individuations of a duck and truck, despite it being both a yellow duck and a yellow truck, right? And so one of the things that we did is we actually asked, we had in our parent report demographic questionnaire, I was thinking, okay, we're going to be really savvy. We've got these like great words. It's going to be awesome. So we asked parents to list out kind of female-esque words and male-esque words. So like mom, dad, girl, boy, aunt, grandmother, grandfather, and all these things. And I was kind of hoping, oh, maybe like the more gendered like nouns they have to describe male and female faces, maybe that will kind of be a prediction or relate to their individuation. Of course it didn't. But, there could be lots of reasons why. Maybe it was power, what all these other things. But I think, for when we think about humans, it's there's so much complexity to this, right? So is it that they are starting to, have their capability of associative learning? Is it that, they see female faces and are able to, at 2 years, start to have this representation of, females are moms and moms do this XYZ and moms look this way versus, you know, and we didn't give them a whole body. Like, we just gave them the faces, right?
Well, that's what you would do anyway.
But, yeah, well, so.
I don't think it's that weird.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, the reason I say that.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I say it's not that weird is because we know with Paul Quinney's show that, like, so now this is completely different in terms of category, but at least with Cats and Dogs, he's shown that infants categorize on the basis of facial features, not bodies. So that's what I would have picked anyway.
Yeah. But they, you know, they can categorize like motion, as I kind of mentioned before. But anyway, so, you know, is it having the words mommy and daddy? But granted, like, a 12-month-old should kind of more or less ideally have a mommy and daddy kind of word associative learning in some capacity. Whether they're actually producing that is, you know, different. But so again, unfortunately, like, the data that I have here, it's not able to really speak to that directly. But, you know, kind of the open question is really trying to get at, well, in the face perception literature, we think about like time spent and the quality of time we spend with the infants and how that's shaping perceptual narrowing. So what's happening? What is infants' attentional systems being drawn to, or what are they keying into in this like 1 to 2 year age range that's starting to inform them that there are these distinctions that can be made between different kinds of people? And in an adult world, we say male and female people, but I don't think we'll necessarily get into the other aspect of this project for my dissertation, but we did the same task, but with white and black faces. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we showed them white female and black female faces. So now we're saying within gender, controlling gender, and then changing kind of what we define as like the race of the face. And so that's data that I'm kind of working up right now and analyzing that piece. And, you know, it's so... In one of the testing sessions we had, is a couple of times we've had babies, when they see a male face come out of the box, they're actually, some of the infants were, the 2-year-olds were labeling that as like daddy, or they say man. And of course, like, parents were like, would get flustered because they would say, oh, that's not dad. I'm like, don't say anything. Like
don't interrupt.
Don't interrupt the session. Like, let this happen. You know, yes. Sitting there squirming. But, you know, what's interesting is that a number of the 2-year-olds...
I like not, to ask again that enough. You do not speak to your kid, please. Thank you.
Yes, and that, like, very nice experimenter voice that you're trying to control.
Remember,
all of
please
this.
Try not to interfere with the
please
test.
Don't do that. No, but, like, and obviously we didn't have enough instances where the infants themselves labeled the faces, but it was kind of this cool piece to see that some of the 2-year-olds were... naming, like, mommy, that's a daddy, right? We did have one infant who happened to be a black child who, when we were doing the white versus black comparison, I was showing her black male faces and white male faces, and the black male faces came out, and this child had a black father, and she named that daddy, but did not name the white faces daddy. So that was pretty cool too, and I was just like, I want more babies to do this. Start to look at this idea of how language and how, you know, obviously language is shaping cognition and our concepts and ideas, right? So is there a way that I can kind of tap into how language might be one of the pieces that are influencing this? So that's still an open question. I don't have that data. But
there's an elephant in the room that we haven't discussed, which I thought was really interesting from your study, which is that infants seem to show different individuation for black and white faces. That is, I think in your study, the 24-month-olds, and this may even be true for the 12-month-olds, they were less able to individuate black faces than they were to individuate white faces. And I guess the question I have for you is, what do you think is driving that effect? Why would it be the case that these infants, in this particular sample of infants, that they would show better individuation of the white faces than they would of the black faces, of the African American faces?
Yeah. So I think it could be to some extent that perceptual expertise piece that's laying some foundation behind that. But I don't necessarily want to say that like white children don't see black faces as human, right? Like that's not I don't necessarily think that's what, but kind of that would be a very extreme way of thinking about this. But I would, it seems more just that, kind of going back to the idea of like, how robust is this response, right? So is it that that these white children have more experiences with white faces, and that potentially that's a kind of a faster way for them to categorize that. But in that, in the, and that was more the case for the 2-year-olds, but not so much for the 1-year-olds. And so it's, I don't know necessarily if we can really say it's perceptual narrowing related.
Was it the case though, Cherise, and correct me if I'm wrong and misinterpreting, but it was like it, when they did individuate, when they were looking, older children were comparing like black faces to a non-human face.
Yes. Yeah.
But
right.
Not
yeah,
when yeah, they yeah. were individuating yeah. a black female yeah. from yes. a black male.
Black male.
So yeah, again, like exactly. you said, not that they yeah, don't yeah, yeah. individuate as human, but that the distinction or difference between a black female and a black male face seemed to be more troublesome or problematic. And I mean, I thought the fact that, you know, you did note that your sample was more so
predominantly white.
Caucasian. Yep, predominantly yes. white.
Like, yep. to me, that speaks to an experience-based argument, mm-hmm. the same as you make mm-hmm. for gender. Like, why might we have preferences for female faces? Because we see them more often. And so if Caucasian children are more likely exposed, and that they would maybe have more experience in individuating those types of faces, and they need right. more experience with African-American faces.
Got to recruit biracial kids. I feel like this would be an
yeah,
interesting...
That's,
I think it would be very interesting,
it's,
actually.
It's on the list.
We're going to okay. keep adding to
it's
your
on
list.
The to-do list.
But
yeah.
I think,
yeah, it is.
I think that
there's a lot... I mean, there's a whole... I could... You know, there's a whole other piece just in general looking at kind of biracial infants and children's kind of expertise, right? Like, what do we get out of the multiplicity effect,
yep.
right? And so that's a whole other thing that, yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that and would love to do ask more questions about with biracial. And also, I think you also brought up, you know, same-sex households, right?
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, thinking about, would you see that gender preference? And you mentioned a study earlier about children that do have more experience with males, and that seems to
yeah.
actually make a difference.
Yeah, there's a couple, and there's a new paper out from Dr. Jennifer Reynolds, who also did a study abroad that had, you know, kind of a natural shift in who was the primary caregiver, which gender of the primary caregiver, and it really did show. Even this was even like after 12 months of age, the change happened, and there was differences in infants' visual perception and
sure.
processing of male and female faces based on who the primary caregiver is. So one,
yeah.
it speaks to obviously the kind of prolonged plasticity of our perceptual or processing systems, right? But yeah, it is kind of interesting to think about, would it be that growing up in a same-sex household that then face gender information is even more important, that maybe the younger infants would see that as maybe the younger infants would be individuating male and female faces? Or is it just still not really as important because, you know, it's a face is a face, it's a human face
right.
kind of piece, right? So that's kind of, yeah, I would definitely be interested in doing that. And it's a matter of, like, finding enough infants.
Yeah,
to,
I'm sure.
You know, and one thing that...
We're just giving you every sample that you
yeah,
will have
well,
20
you know,
years
it's like
finding.
I would, I'm, you know, now that we're so much of our work has to switch to online,
yeah.
And this is, it's not like, you know, if a vaccine comes out, it still doesn't mean that we are not going to be recruiting online, and so it's, for me now, it's the challenge of, like, how could I translate this task
yeah.
appropriate for, say, 1- and 2-year-olds to an online testing session? I don't know. That would be really, if there are anybody who's going to listen to this has an idea about how I could maybe translate this.
Email us. Let us know.
Online. Yeah, yeah. It would be interesting to kind of, as a way to take advantage of recruiting a much larger, widespread way of getting more families of different backgrounds.
Yeah, for sure.
Anybody who knows me knows that I'm, like, my primary interest in development is looking at mechanisms of all sort. And you know, you raise the possibility that one possible mechanism that explains that could explain why infants show this differential individuation of black male and female phases compared to white male and female phases may have to do with experience. And so I guess the question I have for you is, have you thought about doing a training study with non-human phases, but that sort of differ with respect to color, for example, and then sort of manipulate whether or not the faces or the face-like stimuli are of the same race or of different races or colors. I feel like this would really get at whether or not this mechanism that you articulate, which is perhaps perceptual experience or expertise, is driving some of this effect, because this effect is interesting with the 24-month-olds. I mean, there's something there. There's a there.
Yeah.
Right? And I would be curious to know what the mechanism is. And the reason I say that you should probably, I would think that you would probably want to go about this by training on non-human faces, because, you know, they have lots of experience with faces and you really want to get mechanism. And so have you thought about maybe, you know, exploring this mechanism closer, more closely, perhaps in the context of a training study, but not necessarily in the context of a training study?
Yeah, I think I hadn't thought about it in the context of a training study. I think that would be interesting to kind of explore if you had completely novel objects.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just thinking about in the context of Lisa's own work. So she gives them books of strollers, I think, or something like this, right? And I'm sure you can translate that methodology in this context.
Yeah.
Give them books and have the parents read the books for a certain amount of time and then bring them back.
So that's bringing in this piece of, is it language that's really driving the concepts of that allow them to individuate, right? So if we
You can manipulate that too.
Sure.
You can just have them show the pictures and not say anything, right?
Yeah, so. I mean, there's, that could definitely be an interesting kind of avenue to to explore using these novel objects that, you know, with Dr. Scott's work is the Wadgins and the Hitchells.
Yeah, the Wadgins, you're right.
Yeah, the Wadgins and the Hitchells. So, maybe we could use those kinds of things and see, you know, the way in which if they start to develop more kind of kind categorizing.
Yeah, it would it'd just be interesting if you had, if you did have, like, you know, these different groups and you had, you know, Caucasian children that hadn't had exposure as much because of just they don't tend to have this exposure versus intervention where they saw more African-American faces.
Right.
Yep.
And then if you saw that those kids were individuating more.
Then it points then at that mechanism.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So we could look, evidence. Yeah. That would be really, really neat.
And again, you know, you raised the point of like, you know, multiracial infants, like, does kind of seeing more than one race on a regular basis be something that would kind of change, like, the what is it about experience, again getting back to this bigger question of like, how is experience and include language in that experience shaping the way infants are representing people and then like the groups of people that they're seeing. So yeah, I mean, these are all,
we could go on for days, Sheree, sorry, with your work, because it's so exciting and interesting.
One last simple question. Have you replicated this finding with 24-month-olds? Because we're talking about this finding as if it's robust, but is it robust? Does it hold up in the context of replication?
So I have not replicated the male versus female finding yet.
Okay.
I haven't attempted to. So it's not that I've done it and we didn't replicate it. It's just that I haven't had a chance to run this task again with another group of infants.
That's where you would want
to
start.
Sharice needs to solve the pandemic so that we can
get rid of this pandemic so I can start to see babies in person again and walk around with my little blocks of people heads.
It's so funny. You can tell a developmental psychologist on a campus because they carry around toys. Oh, yeah. That's what I was doing.
Right,
got stickers in your back pocket.
Stickers, toys, blocks.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I started doing is, like, starting to size up infants. Like, I'm out in the mall, and I'm like, I wonder how old that baby is.
I do the same thing.
They're walking. They're running. Oh, if they're running, they are way too old for me.
Have you noticed that?
We need to set up a.
Are you pretty good at ages? I'm pretty good at identifying ages now. I can pretty much look at a baby and really?
So.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I don't know if I could say I'm, like, really good at it. And obviously, I mean, again, I don't have kids, so that's the other thing. It's like,
me neither.
Once you have, your child arrives, Dion, you're going to really come
get it. Dion's just going to be home doing every experiment on his child.
Oh, I am. All the classics. Well, I'm tired of showing other people's babies during my infant lectures. I want to be able to show my own baby.
There you go.
Right.
Well, you can do, there's that book out there that, like, 50 experiments you can do on your baby.
Oh, yeah? Okay, I'm going to look that up.
Yeah, you guys got to check that book out. Okay. It's pretty fun. I started buying it for my friends who have babies.
Oh, I like it.
You should do this stuff. And
that sounds fun.
It's a fun book.
Yeah, nice.
Okay, well, we would be remiss. We always have to ask. I think we know we've kept you for a long time, Charisse, but our last fun question we always like to end on is to ask all of our guests. You have followed this path to become a developmental scientist, but what would you be doing if you weren't? Would you be working with dolphins? Is that...
I think I would definitely be in an animal-assisted therapy kind of world. And I don't know, maybe... I can team up with somebody now and collaborate down the road, write a grant on perceptual or cognitive processes that are happening during animal behavior therapies. But I would totally, honestly, if Key Largo, the Island Dolphin Care folks, if they'd offered me a job, who's to say if I would stay and not have gone to grad school, but, I probably would have still ended up going to grad school as a way to just want to learn more and try to ask those questions, right? But I think definitely, it's interesting because I almost went to, instead of following a PhD in developmental psychology, I almost went to occupational therapy school.
Oh, yeah.
And again, so I think I would, if I wasn't doing what I'm doing now, I would definitely be maybe in a more like hands-on child development kind of realm, but I do think I would still be in a child development world, but maybe dolphins would be involved in it too.
I think there could still be dolphins in your future. I will.
Yeah, like I said, I gotta find somebody to collaborate, maybe in like Florida, who has some. Maybe we can come up with some EEG questions or something.
Well, we'll see.
It's your first dad joke, Dion. Good job.
Yeah, hey, I at least try to get one in every single episode. Give me my credit.
Hey, well done. Snaps to you on that.
Yeah, well done, right.
Well done.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
I put a seal on it.
Okay.
We can't have two in one episode, Dion. We got
That was a biting joke.
One dad joke per episode.
Right.
Well, thank you so much, Charisse. This has been a wonderful conversation. You've been a fabulous guest. Thank you for chatting with us today. And thank you to everybody for listening. Check us out and listen to our future episodes. Check us out on social media.
Thank you for having me. This has been a lot of